folks, you're listening to Chew the Fat with Chef Craig Hartman. We're here in beautiful Charlottesville, Virginia, and we're at the highly professional studios of Charlottesville Radio Group, and we're doing an interview today with Ed Hardy up in New York City. Now, Chew the Fat is the podcast where you get an unscripted, totally raw interview that we hope cuts through the fat of a food-related artist's heart and gets right into the meat of their heart, so we can get to know them. Today is a pretty cool story because we have a young chef who's in New York City. Most of us know that that's one of the places that people would love to go to try to make it, but it's also the place where everybody goes to try to make it. So this is a cool thing. You have to work your way up, claw and fight. So we're going to hear from someone who's in the trenches there, working hard in New York City. We have Ed Hardy, who's from Virginia himself, has a lot of family here in Charlottesville. And we're going to find out a little bit about him today. He works for Marcus Samuelson at one of their new concepts, the Red Rooster. He had a chance to feed President Barack Obama recently, which is pretty cool, and I hope to have the chance to feed him too one day. So, Ed, how you doing tonight?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
How's that?
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, how's that weather in New York City?
It's cold. it's cold, and I think it might even snow later on tonight, actually.
Can you believe it? That's yeah. Crazy. So, Ed, give us a little culinary bio of kind of where you started and then kind of up through the different chefs and restaurants that you worked at to get where you are today.
Sure, absolutely. I had a what you'd call an extended career at UVA.
We've heard that before.
I'm from Richmond. Moved out to Charlottesville to go to school, and I kind of wasted my time and my parents' money. For an awful long time.
Your parents will appreciate that, by the way, that you've said that. They will really appreciate it.
Yeah. And after they got tired of basically paying for me, I needed a job.
Sure.
And after 2 or 3 or 4 years in college, you start to understand that girls like guys who can cook.
I see.
So, I had taken to experimenting around in the kitchen, actually, slicing fresh garlic and whatnot. And I needed a job, and I was really interested in cooking. And so I called up Southern Culture, and I answered a want ad, and I said, yes, I would love to cook for you. And they must have been desperate. They took me.
That's awesome.
And so my first job was at Southern Culture, and it was a great jumping off point at that time for me. I moved on later to the Virginian, and I was kind of I guess the head chef there.
Wow.
And then I moved on to what my seminal experience in cooking, which was Melito's in Richmond.
Right.
And that was kind of my crucible, if you will.
Sure.
Then I felt a little career pressure, once again from these parents, which keep on popping up in my life, to maybe, use these degrees that took me so long to get.
Right.
So I kind of took my history and my media degrees, and I went into politics for a while, and ended up moving to D.C., and I was okay at it, but I didn't like anything I was doing. So
Right. There
was a campaign that didn't pay me, and I needed to pay the rent, and so I went back to working as a sous chef for Legal Seafoods on K Street.
Sure.
And then I met the girl of my dreams, and she was getting into cooking, and she lured me up to New York City and French Culinary Institute.
Right.
And so, basically, and that's the story, and here I am still in New York City 4 years later, and I married that nice young lady, and I cooked a little bit for, the Union Square Hospitality Group, which,
sure,
of course, is Michael Romano, and I cooked a little bit for Marcus Samuelson, I did a little private chefing for ING Investment, which was a really, really cushy gig, if you will. And but I wanted to get back into the game, so Marcus needed some help, so I went over to Red Rooster, which opened recently, and I'm back in the trenches. And there you go. That's it.
How's that feel to be in the trenches in New York?
It's tough. It is a tough job. You go in, you'll get a different burn, or two or three burns every shift, and then you pour lemon juice on them.
just to make them feel a little worse.
Yeah, just to okay. feel a little worse. You know, there's always some kind of acid or pickle that you're dealing right. with, and it'll get into whatever sort of paper cut or something that you brushed against your arm, and yeah, you know, and that's kind of a fact of life. You know, you're used to there's a little bit of pain. I mean, I guess we must be masochists or something. I mean, to be in the culinary business, but hopefully, you know, one day soon, I will be more worried about balance sheets and invoices, and I won't have to get, well, then I'll get paper cuts, I guess, from the invoices. But
yeah, then you'll want to be back in the trenches.
Yeah, then I'll want to be back in the trenches and to the burns and the pain that I do understand.
Yeah, sure.
No, but I was for the first couple of weeks going back from my cushy private chef job, I was a little bit, I was worried that maybe I was getting too old for this kind of stuff, but it turns out that the past 12 years of experience cooking really does set me up for success, and I'm moving up the ranks at Red Rooster pretty rapidly.
Sure.
And in the next couple of weeks I expect some sort of announcement from them, but I can't go on record as saying
bum,
that
bum,
yet.
But, we'll do that. I had a chance to do a gig with Marcus Samuelson up at Cornell, and I actually I cooked a tasting menu for him and his staff, and he said, for one of my dishes, do you mind if I put this on my menu? And that's one of my crowning achievements, by the way. So now you get to work with him in his new restaurant, and I think it's a really cool it's a really cool idea. Can you just tell us a little bit about the Red Rooster?
The Red Rooster defies conventional wisdom. It conventional wisdom says that if you're going to open up a restaurant in Manhattan, you do it, below 125th Street.
Right.
But he opened up smack dab on 125th Street up in Harlem, and he said, by golly, I think this community is underserved, and I'm going to open up a restaurant that's going to have a higher price point, and I don't care, and it's going to have some nice service, and I'm even going to put some Swedish food on the menu, as well as some soul food elements and some elements from Middle Eastern and African cuisines. And to be honest, I was a bit wary going in. I was like, well, I'll give this a try because I want to get back in the game. But, lo and behold, everything's worked out nicely.
Right. There's been some great articles out there about the restaurant and how it's being received.
He's turning him into, I liked him and I liked working for him. He's a nice guy to work for. But he's turning me into a believer. I'm starting to drink the Kool-Aid here. I mean, he's purely through the force of will. I mean, he's saying, I'll serve whatever I want. There'll be definitely some soul food elements, but which you and I know, of course, is Southern food.
Right.
And I'll feel free to mix and match and whatever, but as long as I'm serving good, generous portions at a reasonable price with, good service, I think it's going to work, and it's working. So, I am actually really, really happy to be there, especially, like I said, previously, I've rediscovered my talent for being able to organize, moving 60 pounds of meat around, every 5 minutes.
So did the president show up? Did he come to eat?
He did.
Did he like it? Did he have a smile?
Well, unfortunately, and normally you can catch a glimpse of him, but unfortunately, the kitchen staff just weren't get out to see him, and he is overscheduled, especially when it comes to to New York because New York is, you know, a 24-hour city. So he had 10 different engagements. You know, he barely had time to make all of them.
Yeah, sure.
So he didn't have those extra 5 minutes to come into the kitchen, although I'm sure he would have. It's funny. We renovated a space that was formerly just, you know, some nook next to our locker rooms. But because his scheduling demanded it, we needed to kind of provide him a space where he could privately dine with just a couple people, even though this was a dinner for 60.
Wow.
So this basically space where cardboard boxes were 24 hours earlier became one of those restaurant makeovers where this nook was transformed and we hung a crystal ball and we had, you know, tall candles and you know, white linens all around.
That's awesome.
And it became like some gourmet dining nook that I didn't know that was even possible.
I love that. Hey, you know, that's a little stressful, but I know once it comes off, it's cool, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, once Elvis has left the building, everyone relaxes, and it all just becomes, you know, wandering around and having champagne toast, you know, for the fact that we didn't screw things up.
That's so awesome. Hey, well, I'm going to backtrack now. So you said you grew up in Richmond. I met your parents before, the great folks. What kind of culinary life did you have as a kid?
I'm still just rediscovering that. Mom, I'm realizing, I've realized over the past, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, is actually a very, very good cook.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that a lot of American, you know, kind of mid-American cities were, you know, very, very dangerously close to really losing any sort of culinary, how can I put this, past.
Sure.
But mom and I guess grandma, you know, grandma taught mom, you know, how to do soups, sauces, you know, stocks, roux, you know, emulsions and whatever. And so I'm always, when I go home, mom says, oh, why don't you cook, you know, cook for Thanksgiving. But then, then, you know, mom will do one thing. And I'll say, oh, you know, why don't we do a little cornstarch slurry in that, or why don't we do like some French technique? And she'll have another word for this technique, but it's technically
it's the same,
correct,
yeah.
And it's because she was taught in the right way.
Yes, sounds like she was a good influence. You didn't know it until now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and mind you, I mean, she wasn't adventurous or anything. It's not like I mean, I think Mom would be the first to tell you that, like, it was me that kind of was curious about food. But
right. But
was she a good cook? Yeah, you know, the answer is yes. I mean, she always made sure that we had, you know, a meat and two sides,
right. And
definitely one of those sides was green. So I expect to live forever.
That'd be awesome. Hey, how did you then? How did you decide to go to the French Culinary Institute of all the schools that you had a choice to go to?
It was a little bit cheaper than the CIA and a little bit faster.
Right.
And I wanted to be close to this young lady, Francoise, who I know that you know, and your viewers, your listeners will probably know as well.
True.
You know, CIA is upstate New York, but I felt like maybe I should be able to work and go to school at the same time. And it turned out to be true that you can do that. So it seemed like a kind of natural move for me.
What was it about that experience? Was there anything about that experience actually that you can pinpoint that was really off the charts good?
Oh, geez.
You can say no. They're going to listen. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Don't feel under pressure.
I mean, the funny thing is that I'm sort of a mixed mind. French Culinary Institute is full of great people who will definitely teach you what you need to know about cooking. But at that point, you know, I've been cooking for 5 or 6 years.
Sure.
Before I went there, so you could construct an argument where, you know, they have a fine curriculum, but maybe for certain folks, it might be better served if I just was peeling onions for Danielle Ballou or something
during
that time. and saving myself the $40,000.
Well, that could be true.
Yeah. But I mean, do I regret it? No, absolutely not, because it's a great community, and their career services folks are really, really plugged into some of the best job listings that you can imagine.
Right.
So, and I've always had that to fall back on. I feel like sometimes I switch jobs too often, but you know, they're always ready to provide me with leads, you know, on my next opportunity. So.
Right. So did you, you know, you were there in New York City. Did you stage? Did you, you know, work for some of those other restaurants for free while you were there? Or did you just find a job that you could work at while you were in culinary school?
Yeah, my original intention was to just find a job that I could work at. And I ended up working for Danny Meyer's operations over at the Museum of Modern Art.
Sure.
And those are fantastic.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge operation. They have staff dining for the museum staff. They have the Modern and the Modern Barroom,
right,
which are both New York Times, I guess, 3-star restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably some Michelin stars in there as well. They also have Cafe 2 and Terrace 5, which are I would like to say some of the better museum cafes that you'll find anywhere.
Sure.
You know, we have a whole charcuterie program for Cafe 2, which was really neat because, like, you know, it was like a mini kind of like a culinary high school experience for me, where I learned a little bit about Italian, you know, just enough to be dangerous. And you know, beautiful veg and beautiful product.
Sure,
they were all within our reach. So I mean, it was a fantastic experience. And to be honest, I regret leaving in some ways the Danny Meyer fold, because
sure,
he really takes care of his folks. And I've also had a chance, you know, to stage at Gramercy Tavern and to do a couple trails at Union Square Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I did an extended, you know, stage at Cafe Blue, and I also did a stage with Missy Robbins, who is one of the, I guess, Food and Wine Best New Chefs, and she's over at Avoce.
Nice.
And which is neat. It's a really small community. My wife worked for her while she was at Spiaggia in Chicago.
Yeah.
And increasingly, you know, I find that certain elements of the culinary community are really small. I mean, you interviewed Harrison Keeble,
sure,
and
thing.
He was one of my classmates at French Culinary.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's new for me. So
no, yeah, and quite honestly, Harrison and I had running bets about who was going to go down to Charlottesville first and open up a restaurant. And obviously, he's beaten me.
He beat you down know. Here.
He's beaten me like last week's news or something, because I think I owe him $50. I don't know.
I'll go collect it. I'll collect it for you. Don't worry. I'll give it to you. Hey, so for these folks that would listen, you know, we already know that we have a lot of, you know, frontline in the trenches folks that listen. And what would you say to them? What would you say? Hey, you know, if they want to come to New York City, could you give them any advice on breaking in up there?
Well, I mean, call me first, and I'll. I mean, I wasn't kidding when I said
like that.
Now,
that's a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, true.
I wasn't kidding when I said it's a small community. I mean, breaking into New York, yes, it is great if you know somebody.
Sure.
And there are also two blogs that you should follow in
right.
terms of, you know, making sure that you have restaurant opportunities sort of lined up.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to, you know, and if anyone asks, I'd love to share those with them.
Sure thing.
If you know, for example, even if you know, you know, some Charlottesville area chefs,
right,
those folks probably have some contacts for you too if you're looking to cook in New York.
Right.
But it is helpful to have some sort of shall we say juice, I guess.
Right.
Before you come, because I had some bad experiences staging and trailing with various folks too, where there is a bit of snobbery where, you know, you know, some guy will say, oh, we don't have New York experience, you can't handle it. Well,
right.
You know, the busiest grill position is pretty busy.
Right.
And if you work that, or if you held that down in Chicago or Kansas City or wherever, you're probably a good stud. You know,
yeah.
you're probably worth your weight in gold, and you know you shouldn't be looked down upon. But unfortunately, some New York folks do that. So if you just have a little bit of an in, and you know, you just need to make sure you have one or two people that you can call that might know a little bit about what's going on.
Sure thing.
You should be good.
And if someone wants to stage up there, they want to just come up and stay for a month, do they just go to the restaurants and knock on the door, or they still the same thing, try to use your in people?
Staging is a bit easier because, I mean, we'll always take a stage.
Sure.
And you know, you just make sure that your shoes are clean and that you have a sharp knife and you show up and you have a, you know, even if you have a bad attitude, we don't care. after you trail,
you can break a bad attitude.
During your trail, just make sure that you are an eager beaver, and that you're yes chef and no chef and we chef. So yes, I would enjoy cutting 60 pounds of onions for you right now. No problem.
Like that. So let me ask you. We're going to close soon, but how do you feel? That your career is going. Do you feel like you're being successful? What do you think would make you feel successful?
I would love. I'm really at the point where I'm ready to leave New York and quite frankly, come down to the Central Virginia area.
Sure.
And open up a restaurant. So, for all of your listeners, if you are a restaurateur with money burning a hole in your pocket, you can contact me and I'll work for a song because I'm a motivated young person.
Sure.
But I'm really on the verge of maybe I take after my father, who also is his own boss. But
sure.
I really want to see what I can do while
right.
I still have time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I look at folks like, well, you, for example, who I call the dean of Virginia cooking.
I like that. I'll take the dean.
as inspiration, because you've been able to kind of carve out a career where you certainly had a lot of creative control, even
sure.
if not, complete ownership
mm-hmm.
All the time. And I hope I'm not committing any hubris or anything, but
no,
I really feel like, it's time to fish or cut bait. It's time to, and I don't want to do it in New York because I will always be a small fish in a small pond here, and in a big pond.
Yeah.
But, I love Virginia. It's where I'm from. It's my home
sure.
state. It's got great vegetables and it's got great people.
So what kind of restaurant would you love to have, Ed, if you could have any darn restaurant?
I would love to have a really well placed sandwich shop.
There you go.
And mind you, I'll also have I'll take a Gramercy Tavern, converted for Richmond or Charlottesville tastes any day.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to run some sort of place like that. But I will start humble if I can. I'll start off with a sandwich shop, and we will serve the best gosh darn sandwiches you ever saw.
You're allowed to cuss on my show.
with locally sourced meats and salami that I've cured myself and, venison brazola or stuff that I've made, just to be able to play around and to really put smiles on faces and to really kind of connect with some community people would be fantastic.
Right. Yeah, true. True. So what, if you could say anything, I mean, what would you say, or let's put it a different way. If you could say anything right now to people that were listening about Ed Hardy, what would you say about Ed Hardy? If you were like second person, well, Ed Hardy, I say that about myself sometimes, Craig Hartman, no, I'm lying.
I can answer this. my friends consistently, always, literally call me at 2 a.m. in the morning and ask me, Ed, why aren't you on Top Chef? You know, Ed, why don't you have a cooking show yet? And I feel like I'm disappointing everybody because I feel like, okay, if everyone's telling me this, there must be something to it. So, you know, I've auditioned a couple times for a couple shows, and I don't really want to do it because I realize now that the reward is not being famous or not being a famous chef.
Right.
But, you know, the reward is doing nice crafted food that makes people happy. You know, that's the reward, and having a nice business.
Sure.
But yet, as I get older and wiser, there's still that youthful part of me that says, oh, yes, go be famous. Go get that moment of that 15 minutes of fame.
Right.
So, I mean, there's still that in the back of my mind, and especially since I've got, like, dozens of cheerleaders who make me.
Well, speaking of that, because a lot of people are driven by, you know, maybe fame or whatever. What kind of special attributes do you have that you think sets you apart from other people in the kitchen?
I am a unlike some chefs, yourself excluded.
Thank you.
I am a people person. We've been known sometimes our profession, I think, to harbor social misfits. I've kind of whether through training or whether through personality. I was brought up to be a people person, so I love conversations and I love engaging with people. And if I could be a front of the house person, I would.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I think they need me back in the kitchen, and that's sure. kind of what sets me apart. And again, it's going to sound like I'm really high on myself, but I've been told that I'm a whirlwind of creativity, and that I need somebody to kind of, wind me in. But that'll always be good because I'll never run out of ideas.
Sure thing.
In the kitchen. And quite honestly, I depend on to reel me in. She's the perfect yin to my yang, actually.
That's awesome. Well, listen, before I wrap up, this is going to be out there, for the eternity. And how would you like to be remembered? Just in case something happens. No, I'm just kidding. Later. See, you have a lot longer to go to be remembered. But if you know, this is a good way to get insight on people. Because you want to know the heart of people. Ask them how they'd like to be remembered.
I would like for occasionally, like for the next, after I die, for the next 20 or so years, for two or three people each year to remember something that I fed them.
Mm-hmm.
And for somebody to say, I had a really great pecan encrusted softshell crab or something, and it was at that place that Ed Hardy guy cooked it. It was really good, and then he sent us out something extra, and it was fantastic. So it doesn't need to be in any kind of famous cookbooks or videotapes or anything. But if somebody would just remember that I cooked them a good meal and I made them really happy, enough for them to remember it a couple years later. That's how I want to be remembered, and also, of course, as a good husband and father. But also for that other thing I just said.
Well, look, if you make me a pecan encrusted softshell crab, I remember you. Okay.
Okay. All right, you're on.
But listen, it's been great talking to you, and I know people are going to enjoy, and they're going to glean a lot of really good things from listening to you. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Craig. Like I said, you are the dean of Virginia cooking, and I hope that your show and your podcast really kind of bring a new kind of culinary wave to the area, because I'm excited about it. So
well, good. I hope you surf that wave down here, and folks, you've been listening to Chew the Fat. You can find us on ChewFat.net, where the podcast where you hear the real truth and the real heart of chefs and other food personalities. And we hope that you'll sound out. Listen, look at chewfat.net, sound out. Let us know what we can do better. Let us know what chefs you'd like to hear from, what people you'd like to hear from, what questions you'd like us to ask. So anyway, thanks for tuning in. I hope you've been inspired and a little bit appalled. This is Chef Craig Hartman at Chew Fat.
it's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's restaurant was never the name of a restaurant. That was always just the name of this song. And I guess that, well, that's probably why I still call this song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. I wasn't gonna sing the song tonight or this decade, but I realized sometime earlier this year that it had been 26 years since this come out as a movie, and it was 2 years before that that it came out as a record, and it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 30 Thanksgivings ago, 30 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in a restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they used to have a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. Seeing as how they took out all of the pews and having all that room, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, found the place was filled with garbage, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction and headed on toward the town dump. We got there, and there was a sign, a chain across the road, and the sign said, "Closed on Thanksgiving." We had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And so with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one, till we come to a side road. And off of the side of the side road, there was a 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff, there was another pile of garbage. We decided that one big pile would be better than two little ones. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. Just wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obie. I cannot tell a lie. I put it."